You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Kay Gibbons, the author most recently of Sights Unseen. She's written 5 novels in reverse order: Charms for the Easy Life, A Cure for Dreams, A Virtuous Woman, and her first novel, Ellen Foster. The new book is published by Putnam. I'm Michael Silverblatt. I wanted to begin by asking you, I've read that this book took you 8 drafts, and I'm very curious about what that process is like.
It was murder. I was so happy to finish this book. It took 2 years, 8 drafts, and a lot of heartache, a lot of tears, and I was very happy to be through with it. I think with each draft, I developed a character, a different character. So the book evolved through the characters, and I hope never to do that again. I'm hoping with the next book I can just sit down and write it. But my editor did have to drag this book out of me. It was not it was not a pretty sight.
Do you have any idea of why that was?
No, I think perhaps I was fatigued from writing Charms for the Easy Life, and that did come completely sprung forth out of my head onto the paper, and that was fatiguing. And I think for a while maybe I thought I had nothing else to say, and I had to struggle to write it.
Ellen Foster has the feel of a book that just sprang forth. Is that the case?
It did. I wrote Ellen Foster in 6 weeks, and I was not mentally well at the time, but it did spring forth in one manic gush. And I was silly enough to think that that's the way all books were written, that I could be a cross between Barbara Cartland and Eudora Welty, and I could make oodles of money writing literature. But then I found out that these books were going to take me 2 years apiece to write.
Did you moved from... You were one of the pioneers, really, of a brand new press with your first book, mm-hmm. the Algonquin Press at Chapel Hill. And it must have been very satisfying, since your home is North Carolina, and to have your teacher, Lewis Rubin, as your editor for that first book. Did it make you nervous to be moving to a bigger publishing concern?
No, because when I moved from Algonquin, they had been bought by a New York house, and the character of Algonquin had changed dramatically. It was no longer 8 people sitting around a white frame house in Carborough, which is near Chapel Hill. It was dramatically different. And so I was used to New York. It's not a place I enjoy, but it's a place I have to do. So it wasn't that shocking.
Well, Faith Sale, your editor, is certainly one of the best editors for fiction I know. She's been on the show and edits Amy Tan and Alice Hoffman and all of that. How did the book happen to come her way?
I knew her through Amy Tan. I had read The Joy Luck Club when it was in manuscript form, and I got very enthusiastic about it. I knew I had stumbled on something rare, and I wrote Faith, who was the editor of the book, and offered my measly help if she should ever need it for this book. And as it turned out, they didn't need anything from me. But that's how I met her. And then when I was shopping around for editors, she was at the top of the list.
I'm speaking to Kay Gibbons, whose new book, Sights Unseen, has just been published by Putnam. Now, I'm very interested in something, because I reread Ellen Foster just before this interview, I noticed that both books, Ellen Foster and Sights Unseen, end in a sense in the same way. The character has a new mother and is celebrating at the end of the book the newfound mother. And that theme, the theme of finding the mother, occurs over and over again, and I wondered what it might mean to you as a writer.
I think it's most definitely linked to the death of my mother when I was 10, and I've been on this lifelong search for a mother figure, which I probably found in my editor. And I don't have to look any farther. But I had not, until you mentioned it, thought of the connection between Ellen Foster's search for a new mother and Hattie's in Sights Unseen. That's very astute. That's very good.
Well, it's very interesting to me because, you know, finally, at the end of the book, we return to a scene we already know. The mother has come home from the hospital. She has gone through electroshock therapy, and now she is doing some of the things that the narrator, Hattie Barnes, had wished a mother would do all along. And in a certain sense, she does them so bountifully, taking her shopping, telling her stories, you know, making reparations with the older brother, that it reminded me almost of the Eden at the end of Ellen Foster, when that new mother invites the black playmate of Ellen to the house and even embroiders her initials on the towels. And I thought, this is a writer who has a need, a yen, for a happy ending.
I think life is full of unhappy endings. We go bankrupt, we eventually die, bad things happen every day, we can be hit by a bus. So when I create a fictional world, I let bad things happen for 200 pages, and then for the last 10 pages, I don't see why I shouldn't have a happy ending.
I wondered whether it was, in a way, the need to end the book on a high.
Oh, all of my books do. In the fourth book, a woman dies on the last page, but she's made peace with herself and the world, and everyone realizes that that's the logical thing to happen. So maybe I shouldn't say all of these books end happily, rather that they do end logically. And that's one of the major tricks in writing, is to have a logical ending, having a book that doesn't fall apart at the end.
Where did you learn the things that you learned about writing? Because you come to Ellen Foster, I wouldn't say fully formed, but certainly with a very rich voice.
Through reading. In college, I wrote articles and published articles about Katherine Ann Porter and Eudora Welty and James Weldon Johnson, a black poet writing at the turn of the century. So I've always considered myself a student of literature, so it's only natural that I write. If I were a watchmaker, I would take some watches apart before I put one together. And so I think I came at this job not through happenstance or not through taking writing courses, which I really don't believe in for myself, but through reading.
Mm-hmm. When you, do you get the sense, I do at any rate, you know, commit yourself, that a lot of the young writers now aren't reading, that the books are coming from something other than a literary source?
They're reading each other. They're reading. Raymond Carver was good. When he was good, he was very, very good. But when I read things that students send me, they sound like watered-down Raymond Carver. And they're reading Stephen King. And I've read Stephen King, and it's highly entertaining, but it's like living on Cocoa Krispies. Mm-hmm. If one wants to be a literary writer, one needs to read literature.
Was there a book that made you sure that you wanted to do this? Was there a beloved beyond all others book?
I think 100 Years of Solitude and Eudora Welty's Golden Apples and Catcher in the Rye were major landmarks in my life.
I recently, I'm always astonished to find that there's a story by Eudora Welty that I haven't read, but somehow there was one, I don't know how, that I'd skipped over, and a man and woman go on a kind of, I don't know what you would call it. They go into the black section of town, and they are on a kind of romantic spree, but which is also a journey to hell, sort mm-hmm. of like Persephone going down to the underworld. And the flowers and the river and the things that are said to them are so transfixing that I too thought, this would make me a writer if nothing else would. And at the same time, I found it immensely intimidating. Like, what a lot a writer has to know to create the density of this world.
There's some things as a writer that I see Eudora Welty doing that I won't touch. I cannot write a short story. I've written one about a midget doctor, and it didn't pan out. I published it, but it was awful, and I'm embarrassed to see rare book dealers show up with this story. But I won't write short stories the way she can, because I can't do it.
I know, for instance, that the poet Lewis Simpson said that he decided he was a poet because he was a depressive, and he said that the length, the duration of a novel, that his moods could not outlast, mm-hmm. that he would never be able to finish a novel in the same state in which he began it, and that the coherence of a novel was not available to him, whereas the brevity of a poem was within his emotional rhythm. Given that you write in Sights Unseen about manic depression, and there's a history of that, you've mm-hmm. said, in your family, what effect does it have on the writing process?
I find that I write best when I'm in a state of mania called hypomania. That's not, it's certainly not depression, and it's not full-blown mania. On a scale from 0 to 10, it's hanging in there about number 6, uh-huh. and that's where I write best. And I do sometimes wait for that mood to roll around, or I can induce it with drugs, but I like best to wait for it to come around.
It's very interesting, because in this book there's a lot of very close rendering of manic states and depressions, and I wondered, because people are always asking that, does writing help?
I don't feel that writing for me is a cathartic experience. I don't feel better when I'm through. I feel very tired and wrung out and strung out. And writing Ellen Foster did help me make peace with the death of my parents, but that was about it. Writing is my job, and it's something I go to work and do every day. And I don't invest a great deal of my emotion in it. I have a lot of children, and I'm married, and I have to have a lot left over for that. A lot of writers I know aren't married, don't have children, and can get totally involved in a book. But I have to be able to stay in that book 4 hours a day and then come out and cook dinner.
I wanted to ask you to read a section of Sights Unseen. It's a section sort of about midway through the book, and it's as close a rendering of Hattie Barnes's emotional state in mania as you find in this novel. And what I liked about it was the way in which the rhythms of the sentences imitate the rhythms of the thought. Kay Gibbons reading from Sights Unseen.
Father has told me that Mother actually took 2 rolls of film at my 6th birthday party, which was attended only by Mr. Barnes and Aunt Menifee's family. And then she acted on the belief that she was capable of all things, even developing film. She went into the bathroom and shook the film out of the camera and dropped both canisters into a sink full of something she knew would work, like rubbing alcohol. I see her sitting in her slipper chair, chain-smoking, looking at herself in the mirror every time she gets up to check on the film. She soon forgets why the canisters are soaking, so she drains the sink and throws them away. She feels like washing her face, but cannot decide if she would rather do that or buy a piano so she can play anything she wants to. which she believes she can do given the chance, which she had as a girl, although she never performed with distinction at the recitals. But that would not be the case now, not with the music of the spheres in her head. All she has to do is listen, and her fingers will go up and down the keyboard automatically, just like typewriting. She wants to play something fast and complicated, a rhapsody. She can already feel the music starting to flow through her left arm. It is tingling with inspiration, or is it crawling up her sleeve? What would she wear when she played? That is very important to look professional. Her left arm, the one with something, bugs or inspiration or whatever the hell it is, shoots over her head as though she is the first student in the class to think of the answer. Her arm comes back down. She sits on her hand so it will not try to go anywhere. Her arm feels as if it could rotate or as it revolve completely off her shoulder, and she does not like that. All she wants to do is get dressed up. She has the perfect recital gown. In fact, she has two closets packed with dresses Mr. Barnes has bought for her, many still with the tags on them because Frederick rarely takes her any place where he would allow her to wear sequins. She sees herself in one dress after another, and she is beginning to wish things would slow down a bit. She wants to crawl up on the sink and stare at the pores on her face. A thought moves so quickly from one side of her brain to the other that she cannot catch it long enough to lure it out to its end. Trying to make a thought stop, just one, makes her feel faint. That was hard work. I see her collapsing on the slipper chair, almost breaking it and lighting a cigarette. Frederick lets her smoke when she goes fast. Bless him. Bless the gift of music in her soul. She thinks how what she really wants to be is a poet. She would have to go to New York, and that would mean packing. She could just get drunk instead, but then she would vomit. It would be very hard to write poems down on a piece of paper when words fly like scared robins from their nest. It would not be as easy as playing concert classics on the piano. Should she fly to New York, that would be grand. Then she would land, grand in land, see? She does some mental packing, trying to figure out the season without going to the window to see the color and number of leaves on the trees, and then my father comes in. He said he saw that the ruined film in the trash can and got three Simonex from their hiding place. I was doing us a favor, he told me, otherwise she would have terrorized us all.
Kay Gibbons, reading from Sights Unseen, recently published by Putnam. Would you mind talking with me about that passage? Because I think it's a kind of amazing feat. What happens is that the daughter is imagining what must have been her mother's state. Suddenly, though, we are in the mother's head, and then even deeper in, so that what has been vision has now become impersonation, and suddenly you are with the character. And then, as she quivers in front of our eyes, and the prose does too, little flexings like land and grand, then it's as if there's a movement outward, taking in the father who's coming in with the pills, and when the pills arrive, the prose itself settles down a bit, and the vision goes on outward, out of the manic state, to include the father. It seems like such a, you know, a magic feat.
It was hard to do. I'm not going to pretend that it was easy. I worked on that passage for days and days, and had to find exactly the right points at which I could enter and leave and re-enter the mother's head. And it was very difficult.
Is that a passage, then, that stays draft after draft? I mean, when you get it, do you know you have it there?
Yes, I know I have it. The same way a photographer can take 16 rolls of film but take one shot and say, I know that was the one, even though the film is not developed yet. And that's the way I felt with that passage.
A detail in that passage that I like a lot is she's imagining playing the piano, and suddenly she thinks it would be as easy as typing on a typewriter. And suddenly we have the image of the writer herself, the act of typing, and almost, as you talked about it, of getting Ellen Foster in 6 weeks, an experience in which mania is working effectively for the writer. I guess what I found fascinating in the book is that there is that constant interpenetration of selves going on in it. It's not necessarily a part of the story. In the book, Hattie is not necessarily a writer. She's remembering her mother. Mm-hmm. We're not dealing with self-consciousness of that sort. And yet, things keep pointing to the writer, the writer's presence, a presence beyond the book, in a way. Does that make any sense?
It was important for me that Hattie be very present as a narrator, that the reader be cognizant that there was someone who could write, who was telling the story. Not me, but the narrator. And I had to constantly remind the reader of the difference between the narrator and the writer. And I consciously made Hattie a doctor so that her feat of writing the story would seem grander, would seem all the more peculiar, because that's not her specialty. But she can tell the story.
How does Hattie's voice differ from your own as a writer?
I think the voice in this book is much more subdued than what I am. The voice that's closest to mine is the voice of Charlie Cates in Charms of the Easy Life or Ellen Foster's. I could have spoken Ellen Foster into a tape recorder. That's how I think, that's how I write, that's how I talk. But this woman is an adult. She's responsible, she's sane. And so I had to work at this voice. It didn't come magically.
In Charms for the Easy Life, Charlie's sister kills herself on the instruction, she believes, of Theodore Roosevelt,
yes,
who's written a letter to her suggesting that it's time that she go.
Right.
She has, of course, written this letter herself. The letter is reproduced with her misspellings and the way she imagines Roosevelt is talking to her. In Sights Unseen, the mother, Maggie, goes riding off to a store because she's heard on the radio show, Come Ron Down, and she jumps right up. Madness has stalked the women throughout these books. Is it a necessary subject for you?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just worked out that way. I'm working now on a Civil War novel, and I may have some mad women in there, but I'm going to have Sherman. I'm going to have the Southern women deal with Sherman. And so far, I have mental illness. It won't play a part. Medical folklore will, lots of that. I plan to have some battlefield surgeries performed on kitchen tables and pianos. But it will be quite a departure from the other books.
I've always wondered, because it's always been my belief that autobiography is the source of one's material, but the art is entirely separate from that. You can't help as a writer but be who you are, but as an artist, you can be anything at all. Could you speak about the formation of your literary style?
I think, as I'd said, it began with reading, and while I do use the authority that I have, for example, I know about manic depression because I have it, but I did not replicate experience in the book. It is reality filtered through the imagination, and I believe that my style is characterized by art and craft, art that seemingly effortless flow of language, and then craft coming back in and putting a highly stratified structure on the book. So I really do use both sides of my brain when I work.
The thing that many people have commented on is that these are literary novels, and yet they are very accessible and even popular. And that's a rarity, and you know that seems to be the result of quite conscious deliberation. How do you be literary in an unliterary culture and reach an audience?
I have a very strong publisher. I have an editor who's the best literary editor in New York, and the commercial end of the house really pushes the fiction. So,
but I'm talking about the style. That is to say, you've made it. I can tell in this prose style that you're capable of a level of complexity that is not in these books, but the sentences mm-hmm. do amazing things, but in a very transparent language. And it seems very important to you to keep the books.
It's important to me to keep literature accessible. If I were to sit down and write an article about Proust, I can turn on my brain and I can wow someone with my intelligence. But I don't feel the need to do that in the book. I feel the need to in my books, I feel the need to represent and hold forth to readers the highest ideals in the world about life and death, love, honor, art, justice, and truth in the simplest language possible. So I want to simplify the language without simplifying the concept, and that's very hard to do.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
I've been speaking to Kay Gibbons, the author most recently of Sights Unseen, published by Putnam. She's the author as well of Ellen Foster, A Virtuous Woman, A Cure for Dreams, and Charms for the Easy Life. Thank you for joining me. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica.
Too. Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book, off the mouse, clock time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.